You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for the November 26th Sunday reading of the Denver Post. My name is Diane Adler. Today we will be reading the following main articles. Pueblo Chemical Depot, turning a burden into a benefit. Congress must fund cleanup so weapons site can be redeveloped, by Bruce Finley. Israel-Hamas at war. After delay, more swaps. Tensions underscore fragility of ceasefire that halted fighting, by Jalil Boatel, Najib Jobain, Joseph Fetterman, Sami Magdi, and Bassem Mrui. More early cancer cases. Woman found lump at just 22, by Meg Wingerter. Neurodegenerative diseases. Coloradans turn toward ping pong for rehabilitation. Neuropong participants' improvement has caught the eye of researchers, by Elizabeth Hernandez. And following up with miscellaneous articles. Pueblo Chemical Depot, turning a burden into a benefit. Congress must fund cleanup so weapons site can be redeveloped, by Bruce Finley, The Denver Post. Avondale, the nation's outlawed chemical weapons stashed in 780,000 steel shells here at the Army's Pueblo Chemical Depot, 2,613 tons of molasses-like goop designed to inflict blisters, blindness, and burns from World War II through the Cold War have been destroyed, International Arms Treaty overseers certified. But this military base on 36 square miles of what was once the short grass prairie along the Arkansas River is still bleeding TNT, trinitrotoluene, which causes liver and nerve problems, and TCE, trichloroethylene, which causes kidney cancer, in underground plumes of contaminated water. Thousands of old bombs, grenades, and other munitions are scattered under the wind-whipped topsoil and weeds. Colorado officials estimate cleaning the site to meet the industrial use standard will cost more than $600 million. It costs U.S. Department of Defense, which owns the site, is legally obligated to cover, although Colorado wants the land back. But if Congress fails to maintain a long-term focus and provide funds each year, state health officials and redevelopment authorities warn, the once healthy prairie will remain a wasteland, more of a burden than a benefit. We cannot reuse the property if it is not clean, said Russell DeSalvo, executive director of Pueblo Plex, a state entity created by lawmakers in 1994 to redevelop the site. We just want to make sure the Army fulfills its obligation to clean up this property. It will hamper our economic development efforts if the property is unusable due to environmental contamination. Our congressional delegation will have to be diligent over a long time to hold the Department of Defense accountable to do what they say they're going to do for the people of Colorado, DeSalvo said. It is unsellable if it is not cleaned up. It becomes a burden for the community and for the Army and for the state to monitor this contamination in perpetuity if it is not handled appropriately, he said. People could be killed if they find a piece of unexploded ordnance that may be live. Mustard gas gone. For 80 years, the land served the World War II and Cold War military purpose of storing deadly mustard gas weapons. Then, the United Nations-backed Chemical Weapons Convention, ratified by the United States in 1997, prohibited making, stockpiling, selling, and using chemical weapons. U.S. military officials contracted with Bechtel to build a $6 billion plant to destroy them safely. Starting in 2016, a carefully trained force of 2,600 workers from Pueblo and Colorado Springs ran that plant. Workers wore protective white respirator suits. They operated machines that removed mustard gas by blasting 105-degree water into each of those 780,000 shells. President Joe Biden last summer praised the workers, along with their counterparts at weapons storage bases in Oregon and Kentucky, for successfully getting rid of all of the outlawed weapons. On October 6, arms treaty officials at the Netherlands-based Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons sent a letter to Bechtel certifying the total elimination of the mustard agent. The United States was the last of 193 signatory nations to comply. Colorado senators now are pushing legislation to enable a swift transfer of the land just east of Pueblo back to local control no later than July. Meanwhile, Army officials are negotiating with the Colorado Department of Public Health and the Environment to establish a cleanup plan. The federal process for reusing military bases requires that Colorado buy back the land once Army officials officially decommission the base and redesignate it as surplus. CDPHE officials emphasize in a response to Denver Post queries that the Army is responsible for cleaning up all remaining areas as long as contamination remains. Bechtel started dismantling its plant, and company officials estimated this will take 30 months. Workers will break down much of the facility, including titanium pipelines and vats, necessary because of mustard gas residue contamination. They'll reduce the facility to pieces that they can fit into steel drums, which trucks will haul to hazardous waste dumps. "We're doing this for the future," said Walton Levi, the federal government's project manager for the plant. "I have a daughter. We want to leave the world a better place." Railway and aerospace testing hub envisioned. Colorado officials envision a massive industrial research and development hub if all goes as planned. For years, Puebloplex officials have been working under a master lease agreement with the Army to sublease safe parts of the property to the Association of American Railways, the United Launch Alliance, a space launch venture by Boeing and Lockheed Martin, and others. An eventual resale would enable, beyond possible jobs, the collection of taxes that could boost the economy in southern Colorado. The rail transportation work conducted by MXV Rail, MXV is the mathematical formula for momentum, brought an investment of $30 million. MXV installed a 60-foot-thick concrete crash testing wall and a 6-mile rail loop for analyzing high-speed trains and managing derailments. MXV also created a facility for training rail emergency responders. Puebloplex marketers tout the proximity to Pueblo's airport, US 50, railways, and the Evraz steel mill, where employees produce state-of-the-art 1,500-foot seamless rails. Some 1,000 concrete quonset-shaped storage bunkers, which provide constant 50-degree storage conditions, are available for $1,700 a month. One of the 500 or so tenants keeps a collection of antique cars. A Pueblo organization devoted to helping the homeless stores cots in one. But using the units for housing is problematic because the land at the site isn't classified as safe for residential use, DeSalvo said. Antelope roam between the bunkers, and U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service biologists this fall released 22 black-footed ferrets, an endangered species, to revive grasslands on the eastern side of the site. The federal government lacked the funds to purchase a depot for conversion to a wildlife refuge, as was done in Metro Denver with the 11-square-mile Rocky Flats and 25-square-mile Rocky Mountain Arsenal weapons-making sites. Cleanup concerns. Cleanup anxieties have intensified since Biden trumpeted the destruction of weapons. Toxic groundwater and potentially explosive old munitions could prohibit redevelopment by increasing liabilities for future owners, DeSalvo said. "We have to be super careful so that we don't acquire any liability." The CDPHE for decades has been charged with regulating all activities at the Pueblo Chemical Depot. State environmental officials say they regularly review work plans, conduct inspections to verify complete cleanup, and evaluate water and soil sampling data to ensure state standards are met. In this case, conditions safe enough for industrial use. If standards aren't met, state officials can impose controls on future land use. A new permit specifying what the Army now must do should be completed this year and made public, health officials said. The Pueblo Diplo will be cleaned up. CDPHE Hazardous Materials and Waste Management Division Director Tracy White told the Denver Post, "Our primary goal is protecting human health, the people who are using that water. We still monitor very closely the off-site contamination." Nearby residents said they still feel vulnerable. 2 miles south of the depot, people in the Avondale farming community, population 500, including former depot workers, had filters and water cleaning systems installed by the Army so nobody would drink water from wells. Those are still in place, but some residents say they buy bottled water. "Water here is an issue," said Erica Berner, owner of Chuck's Place, a local bar and restaurant established in 1928. A 96-year-old customer advised her never to drink local well water, Berner said. She invested $37,000 to install a water vending machine that dispenses purified H2O for a fee outside Chuck's Place. She runs that dispenser at a loss because she can't bear to charge residents of Avondale and neighboring Boone more than 30 cents a gallon for a commodity essential for life, she said. "We would hope the Army would clean it up before they leave. We are in a disaster zone." CDPHE officials said they monitor water in the towns and plumes that extend beyond the depot, but there is no evidence drinking water is tainted. Army committed. At the site, water tests conducted by the Army show a gradual decrease in the TNT and TCE concentrations in groundwater from as much as 250 parts per billion in 2009 to less than 60 parts per billion this year after water is filtered, state officials said. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency has set a health advisory guidance level for TNT in drinking water at 2.2 parts per billion, or ppb, and a maximum limit for TCE at 5 ppb. The Department of Defense is committed to full cleanup, said the Army's Pueblo Chemical Depot commander, Colonel Rodney McCutcheon, a chemical weapons expert whose experience includes dealing with munitions stockpile found in Iraq. "The Army is not going to leave here until everything is 100% good to go," McCutcheon said. "We housed a strategic deterrent against our enemies, the Russians, for years. We did that safely and securely. And now, the community here will benefit." However, on a recent ride around the land, he and DeSalvo acknowledged that Congress must stay the course for cleanup to be done. "We need Congress to function effectively," DeSalvo said. "We need long-term environmental remediation. Congress needs to authorize that each year. When there's no funding, cleanup just gets delayed. Some projects, if they were fully funded up front, could be completed quickly." Colorado officials said the most costly cleanup task will be clearing a 7,000-acre area where munitions are buried. On August 6, 1948, a lightning strike at the depot triggered detonations and the scattering of explosives, according to military records. First, electromagnetic surveys must be done to locate explosives. Of 62 sites where unexploded materials are concentrated, 22 are classified as problem areas, said Dustin McNeil, leader of the CDPHE's Federal Facilities Remediation and Restoration Team. Another long-term challenge will be monitoring and filtering out the toxic pollution from groundwater, which was contaminated after Army operators spilled industrial solvents and dumped explosives, McNeil said. Much of the toxic material has been confined to the property. There are some off-site excursions, McNeil said. Large-scale water cleaning systems have been running for years and must continue to remove and contain contaminants. The groundwater flows south from the base toward farm fields and the Arkansas River, about 2 miles south of the depot. At one of the treatment plants, TCE contaminated water pumped to the surface is aerated, a treatment that could be compared to bubblers in a fish tank, said Ann Mead, the Army's remediation project manager. The cleaned water is then reinjected into the ground. At the southwestern side of the site, pumps raise groundwater to the surface, where it is circulated through charcoal filters to remove TNT and other contaminants. State data provided to the Denver Post shows that Army water cleaning systems last year pumped more than 215 million gallons of water from 78 wells for treatment to remove TCE and TNT. The point of this is to stop the contamination at our boundary, Mead said. However, sustained water treatment over the next 25 years, she said, depends on funding. Jobs uncertain. U.S. Senators John Hickenlooper and Michael Bennett were not made available to discuss cleanup issues and did not respond to queries about cleanup. They've introduced legislation in Congress that would direct the Army to close the Pueblo Chemical Depot no later than July, a year after the completion of the chemical weapon destruction. Then, under the military's base realignment and closure process, the site would be sold to Puebloplex, the local redevelopment authority. Puebloplex officials said they will take ownership this year of a 16,000-acre portion of the site. The legislation would enable a transfer of the remaining 7,000 acres from the Army to Puebloplex. The primary objective for Colorado has been generating jobs in the economically ailing southern half of the state. During the Cold War, the weapons depot employed as many as 8,000 workers, second to Pueblo's steel mill in sustaining the southern Colorado economy. Now Bechtel's workforce is shrinking gradually, and notices posted at the plant advise employees of upcoming opportunities for retraining. We're going to lose about 2,000 jobs over the next 5 years, DeSalvo said. That will have a huge negative economic impact, and that's why we're ramping up our efforts. Israel-Hamas at war. After delay, more swaps. Tensions underscore fragility of ceasefire that halted fighting. By Jalal Boitel, Najib Jobain, Joseph Fetterman, Sami Magdi, and Bassem Rue. The Associated Press, Albira, West Bank. Hamas on Saturday released 17 hostages, including 13 Israelis, from captivity in the Gaza Strip, while Israel freed 39 Palestinian prisoners in the latest stage of a four-day ceasefire. The late-night exchange was held up for several hours after Hamas accused Israel of violating the agreement. The delay underscored the fragility of the ceasefire, which has halted a war that has shocked and shaken Israel, caused widespread destruction across the Gaza Strip, and threatened to unleash wider fighting across the region. The war erupted October 7th when Hamas terrorists in Gaza burst across the border into southern Israel, killing at least 1,200 people, mostly civilians, and abducting 240 others, including women, children, and older people. Hamas has been designated as a terrorist organization by the United States, Canada, and the European Union. Israel immediately declared war, carrying out weeks of airstrikes and a ground offensive that have left more than 13,300 Palestinians dead, according to health authorities in the Hamas-controlled territory. Many of those killed in Gaza have been women and minors. The ceasefire, brokered by Qatar and the United States, is the first extended break in fighting since the war began. Overall, Hamas is to release at least 50 Israeli hostages and Israel 150 Palestinian prisoners. All are women and minors. Israel has said the truce can be extended by an extra day for every additional 10 hostages freed, but has vowed to resume its offensive quickly and complete its goals of returning all hostages and destroying Hamas's military and governing capabilities. The plight of the hostages has gripped the Israeli public's attention. Thousands of people gathered in central Tel Aviv on Saturday in solidarity with the hostages and their families. Many accused Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of not doing enough to bring the hostages home. The releases have triggered mixed emotions. Happiness, coupled with angst over the scores of hostages who remain in captivity. The office of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu announced early today that it had received a new list of hostages slated to be released later in the day in the third of four scheduled swaps. In the West Bank, hundreds of people burst into wild celebrations for a second night as a busload of Palestinian prisoners arrived early today. Teenage boys released in the deal were carried on the shoulders of well-wishers in the main square of the town of Al-Bira. But the mood of celebration was dampened by scenes of destruction and suffering in Gaza. The start of the pause brought quiet for 2.3 million Palestinians in Gaza, who are reeling from relentless Israeli bombardment that has killed thousands, driven three-quarters of the population from their homes, and leveled residential areas. Rocket fire from Gaza militants into Israel also went silent. War-weary Palestinians in northern Gaza, where the offensive has been focused, returned to the streets, crunching over rubble between shattered buildings and at times digging through it with bare hands. At the Indonesian hospital in Jabalaya, besieged by the Israeli military this month, bodies lay in the courtyard and outside the main gate. For Imad Abu Hajar, a resident of the Jabalaya refugee camp in the Gaza City area, the pause meant he could again search through the remains of his home, which was flattened in an Israeli attack last week. He found the bodies of a cousin and nephew, bringing the death toll in the attack to 19. His sister and two other relatives are still missing. "We want to find them and bury them in dignity," he said. The United Nations said the pause enabled it to scale up the delivery of food, water, and medicine to the largest volume since the resumption of aid convoys on October 21st. It was also able to deliver about 35,000 gallons of fuel, slightly more than 10% of the daily pre-war volume, as well as cooking gas, a first since the war began. In the southern city of Khan Yunis, a long line of people with containers waited outside a filling station. Hossam Fayyad lamented that the pause in fighting was only for 4 days. "I wish it could be extended until people's conditions improved," he said. For the first time in more than a month, aid reached northern Gaza. The Palestinian Red Crescent said 61 trucks carrying food, water, and medical supplies headed there on Saturday, the largest aid convoy to reach the area yet. The UN said it and the Palestinian Red Crescent were also able to evacuate 40 patients and family members from a hospital in Gaza City to a hospital in Khan Yunis. The last-minute delay created a tense standoff on the second day of what's meant to be a 4-day ceasefire. By nightfall, Hamas alleged that aid deliveries permitted by Israel fell short of what was promised and that not enough was reaching northern Gaza. Hamas also said not enough longtime prisoners were freed in the first swap on Friday. But Egypt, Qatar, and Hamas itself later said the obstacles had been overcome. Shortly before midnight, Hamas released the hostages, 13 Israelis and 4 Thais. The Israelis were turned over to Egypt and transferred to Israel, where they were taken to hospitals to be reunited with their families. Hamas released a video showing the hostages appearing shaken, but mostly in good physical condition, as mass militants led them to Red Cross vehicles headed out of Gaza. Some of the hostages waved goodbye to the Hamas fighters. One girl was on crutches and wore a cast on her left foot as she was escorted away. More early cancer cases. Woman found a lump at just 22. Prevalence is rising in women under 50, especially breast cancer, by Meg Wingerter, The Denver Post. Loveland. Devin Brown knew not to ignore it when she found a lump in her breast. It just didn't seem quite right. "It felt very round and hard, so that was pretty abnormal," she said. A biopsy confirmed she was right to worry. The lump was cancerous, and so Brown, a 22-year-old Loveland resident, joined the unenviable growing group of young people fighting cancers that generally have been considered diseases of later life. Nationwide, the rate of cancers before age 50 increased about 4.4% in women from 2010 to 2019, but it decreased about 4.9% in men. Breast cancer accounted for the largest share of early diagnoses, although rates increase faster for cancers of the digestive system. most of the increase came from people in their 30s, with rates holding steady for other groups. It's not just an American phenomenon either. Cancer diagnoses worldwide in people 14 to 49 increased 79% from 1990 to 2019, according to a study in the British Medical Journal of Oncology. Some of the increase may reflect that more people are being screened for cancers before age 50, meaning more tumors are likely to be found. But the study's authors suggested other factors also are involved. Dr. Virginia Borges, director of the Young Women's Breast Cancer Program at UC Health, said that although breast cancer is most common in older women, about 27,000 patients under 45 are diagnosed each year nationwide. It is significantly rarer in women in their 20s, and those who develop breast cancer that young usually have a clear genetic predisposition, she said. That was the case for Brown. She knew she had a family history of cancer and was planning to get genetic testing even before her diagnosis. When she did get tested later, she found out she had a variant of the BRCA1 gene that increases the risk of breast and ovarian cancers. She opted to get a double mastectomy and might have surgery to prevent ovarian cancer in the future. It scares me more to possibly have to go through this again than to just do that, she said. BRCA1 and BRCA2 are the best-known genes linked to breast cancer, but there are seven others that appear to increase risk, Borges said. That's why it's important to know your family history, because tests that look for only a few genes may miss others that raise risk, she said. Family history includes not only parents and grandparents, but any aunts, uncles, or cousins who had any type of cancer, Borges said. Although breast cancer is extremely rare in men, some of the same genes increase the risk of other cancers, so having multiple male relatives with cancer may be a warning sign, she said. Cancers that were diagnosed before age 50 are especially important to note, as are ovarian cancers. If genetic testing uncovers a reason to be concerned about cancer risk, people can start their screening earlier, Borges said. Some women consider mastectomies or removing their ovaries or fallopian tubes if they've given birth to any children they intend to have, she said. Research suggests ovarian cancer may often start in the fallopian tubes, and removing them would give patients another preventive option without pushing them into sudden menopause, as removing the ovaries does. These screening tests don't prevent the cancer, but they can help catch the cancer early, she said. Earlier this year, the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force issued a draft recommendation that women at average risk start receiving mammograms at 40, down from the previous recommendation that they wait until they turn 50. High-risk women have the option to start even earlier if they and their doctors believe it's appropriate. Although genetics are a strong clue as to whether a person may experience cancer early in life, not everyone who gets breast cancer at a young age has one of the clear risky genes, Borges said. There could be risk factors that stretch back generations, but right now, no one's sure what they are, she said. There's no clear pattern, she said. Dr. Mary Beth Terry, a professor of epidemiology at Columbia University, said it's still not entirely clear why early onset breast cancer is rising, but research has been able to rule out some simple explanations. Rising obesity may be a factor in the increase in gastrointestinal cancers and increase the risk of breast cancer late in life. But women who have obesity are at no higher risk of early breast cancer than those who are leaner, she said. Likewise, decisions about childbearing don't appear to be the main factor, Terry said. The earliest American cancer registry, which covers Connecticut, shows early onset breast cancer has been rising since the 1930s, before hormonal contraceptives came onto the market and through relative booms and busts in fertility. And today, breast cancer is rising in younger women in societies where women are more likely to delay or forego having kids, and in those where the average family has half a dozen children, she said. For a long time, the assumption was that early onset cancers were genetic, and later ones were caused by people's environments and behaviors, Terry said. But research has shown that's a false dichotomy. The exact mix of factors varies from person to person. Every cancer is because of your genes and your environment, she said. The most likely environmental factors contributing to the risk are increasing rates of heavy drinking among young women, changes in the average person's diet, differences in childhood infections, which shape the community of bacteria living inside us, and chemical exposures during puberty, pregnancy, lactation, and menopause, Terry said. Those periods are particularly significant because the breast tissue is changing, she said. There is a risk between an increased risk of breast cancer and even moderate drinking, but if women don't want to stop entirely, they can reduce the risk by not binge drinking, Terry said. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention define binge drinking as 4 or more drinks in quick succession for women and 5 or more for men. If you take something in fast, and it's a carcinogen like alcohol, your body can't clear it and repair the damage, she said. One factor that temporarily increases breast cancer risk for young women is having a child, Borges said. Giving birth and breastfeeding decrease the risk of developing breast cancer after menopause, when most diagnoses happen. But for reasons that aren't clear, the risk goes up for the 10 years after having children. That said, even women who have genetic risk factors for breast cancer should be able to have children if they choose, she said. We want women who want to have a child, she said. People who develop cancer earlier in life have more time to live with potential adverse effects from both the tumor itself and the treatment. Although breast cancer can be more aggressive in young women, especially young mothers, there's a good chance of curing those patients if they discover the cancer early, Borges said. That means it's particularly important to keep young patients' goals in mind, particularly whether they want to preserve the option to have biological children, she said. That can involve either harvesting eggs before beginning chemotherapy or giving a drug that basically puts the ovaries into a dormant state, limiting damage to the eggs. It's kind of like turning them into sleeping beauty under the glass, she said. Although breast cancer is still far less common in younger women than in those who have been through menopause, it's important to be aware of your body and get screened if something seems wrong, Terry said. Female firefighters and military members have a somewhat elevated risk because of exposures on the job. And new mothers need to know that pregnancy hormones can feed any small tumors that may have been present in their breasts, she said. Women know their own bodies, and doctors shouldn't say, "You're too young for breast cancer," she said. Brown urged other young women to find out their family history and to get genetic testing and early screening if they find something that concerns them. In her case, the tumor was at stage 2, meaning it hadn't spread outside the breast and is likely to respond well to treatment. My cancer is not only treatable, it's curable. If I hadn't found it as early, it might not have been, she said. Neurodegenerative diseases. Coloradans turn toward ping pong for rehabilitation. Neuropong participants' improvement has caught the eye of researchers, by Elizabeth Hernandez, the Denver Post. Mark Lauterbach was leaving a brewery in Fort Collins this year when he found himself being pelted by hail. Instinctively, he took off running toward his car. When he made it, he burst into tears. "I felt like Forrest Gump," Lauterbach said. "I ran, and I just cried. It's been incredible." The 58-year-old, diagnosed with multiple sclerosis 8 years ago, thought his running days were long over, but playing ping pong, he said, had brought back the gift of running. Lauterbach credits table tennis for a vast improvement in his overall mobility. The Colorado-based NeuroPong program he participates in is now being researched by scientists investigating the link between neurodegenerative conditions and the game often associated with parents' basements. After his diagnosis, Lauterbach dealt with neuropathy along the right side of his body that rendered the movement of his arm, hand, leg, and foot difficult. He developed balance problems and could no longer run or ride his bike around Fort Collins. But about a year ago, Lauterbach received an email from the Multiple Sclerosis Society about a ping-pong group established to help people with neurodegenerative diseases such as MS, Parkinson's, and dementia. The NeuroPong program, led by founder and CEO Antonio Barbera, marries medicine with the love of the game. Barbera brings his 31 years as a physician, interrupted by an MS diagnosis in 2017, while 27-year-old Peruvian table tennis champion Francesca Vargas provides the ping-pong expertise as head coach and fellow MS patient. After about 3 months of sessions inside a Fort Collins church gymnasium under the tutelage of Barbera and Vargas, Lauterbach began regaining his balance and learning actual ping-pong technique. Researchers at the Movement Disorder Center on the University of Colorado's Anschutz Medical Campus were so intrigued by the anecdotal success stories they heard that they began studying their NeuroPong players' symptoms and tracking their improvements for their research. "Table tennis is not a miracle," Barbera said. "The paddle is not a miracle. What is magic is your brain. Bridging physical, mental, and social health." Barbera, a gynecologist for more than 30 years, lost his ability to work after his MS hindered control of his right arm and leg. He also experienced chest tightness, an uncomfortable feeling Barbera likened to an elephant sitting on his torso. In 2019, Barbera was playing ping pong in his garage with his son when he noticed something. "It was like the elephant was sitting in a chair on the other side of the room, leaving me alone," he said. Barbera felt better when he played the tabletop game, but the former physician wanted the backing of science to better understand why. He consulted neurologists, physical therapists, and scientists to learn more about how exercise and socialization can improve cognitive function and whether ping pong might be an ideal form of rehabilitation for people with neurodegenerative diseases. The motor function, quick decision-making, hand-eye coordination, and side-to-side movement involved in table tennis could be a perfect storm for boosting cognitive function, he thought. Barbera founded NeuroPong in 2021. Now, he oversees the program with about 60 players between Boulder and Fort Collins sessions. Players come in various skill levels. Some have trouble walking and standing. Some use a wheelchair. Others have tremors or little control over their limbs, Barbera said. Many have never before picked up a paddle. Players range in age from young folks to those in their 90s and have different neurodegenerative conditions that impact their nervous systems. When a new player joins the crew, Barbera assesses them to see where they should begin. Some players hang onto the ping pong table and practice walking back and forth along it, or tossing the ball into the air and catching it. Barbera and Vargas hover close by, keeping an eye on players' balance and movement control. Vargas teaches basic table tennis techniques, including how to serve and hit. She practices with the players, lobbing the ball in such a way as to set them up for success. But a successful volley is not the ultimate goal. "What I care about most is the entire person," Barbera said. Patients' mental health is considered too, as Barbera and researchers inquire how players are feeling emotionally and socially. For Lauterbach, the group has provided a community of people who understand what he's going through, friends that can grab a coffee together after sessions. This month, Lauterbach beamed in the Fort Collins Church Gymnasium while demonstrating his ableness to balance on one leg, something he once couldn't do, while surrounded by his newfound friends. "There is fellowship, and that helps too," Lauterbach said. "I work my whole schedule around ping pong because I hate missing it." Research is promising. Vargas also goes to great lengths to attend NeuroPong. To get to her head coaching job, the 27-year-old bikes to a bus stop in her Highlands Ranch neighborhood, rides the bus to Fort Collins, and bikes to the church the group uses as home base before doing it all again to head home. When the Peruvian professional ping pong player was diagnosed with MS 2 years ago, she thought her days of table tennis were over. Dizziness and balance and vision problems plagued her, but the athletic young woman felt she couldn't let the diagnosis define her. Instead, Vargas got back in the saddle with her ping pong paddle and competed in another Peruvian table tennis championship 6 months after her diagnosis, and won. "Something inside me said I could do it," Vargas said. Vargas vacationed in Denver to visit friends soon after. She ended up connecting with Barbera. The ping pong champion had been private about her diagnosis, telling only close friends and family, because the medical condition put her in a dark place, she said. Barbera offered her a job and a chance to be open about her journey, which Vargas couldn't resist. "Maybe this is my destiny, to help people that are doing the same as me and going through the same as me," she said. Throughout a recent NeuroPong practice, Vargas was met with smiling hugs from her trainees, who gushed over her friendliness and dedication. Vargas volleyed the ball back and forth, coaching with kindness and encouragement, while Barbera came around correcting posture, recommending stretches, and assessing how everyone was faring. "I can see that this program is improving people's symptoms," Vargas said. "People are getting stronger. People who could not stand on their own at first are now doing so. People are having better control of their movements. They tell me they can open jars when they couldn't before. It's really improving quality of life." So far, the science agrees. Matthew Woodward, a fellow at CU Anschutz's Movement Disorder Center, said the results of their studies to date, looking at outcomes such as balance improvement, movement, and mood, show no negative results. "The results need to be tested on a larger population to be statistically significant," Woodward said. But the research, this first study focuses solely on Parkinson's disease, looks promising. "Additional research is on the way," Barbera said. "Exercise is the only thing doctors and scientists have found to slow the progression of Parkinson's," Woodward said. He recommends 30 minutes of exertion 4 to 5 times per week. Table tennis is unique in that it combines several challenges to stimulate the brain, including hand-eye coordination, balance, motor functions, and speed, while also being a bit more low-impact and manageable than other sports, Woodward said. Mark Kelly, 73, helped pack up the ping-pong tables in the Fort Collins Church after a November practice with his friends. "The program is so much more than ping-pong," he said. "The physical therapy and friendship have changed his life. When I'm playing, it's like my Parkinson's melts away," Kelly said. Boulder. Official will improve university's tribal ties. Benny Shendo Jr. sees education as a key to community's renaissance, by Saja Hindi, The Denver Post. Benny Shendo Jr. didn't know he was supposed to fail. The odds were stacked against him, the result of generations of systemic barriers facing Native Americans after the U.S. government stole or forced the sale of their lands, banned their languages and religious practices, and attempted to strip their identities from them. The friends around him in Jemez Pueblo in New Mexico weren't succeeding. They weren't graduating from college, and in many cases even enrolling, in large part because they didn't feel welcomed. "I just kept going and doing what I needed to do and made it, despite all the obstacles and things that I could have easily walked away from," Shendo, 59, recalls. That determination is what drives him now as he focuses on future generations of students. In October, he began working at the University of Colorado, returning to his alma mater as its first ever Associate Vice Chancellor for Native American Affairs. In the role, Shendo, a New Mexico state senator for more than a decade, will work to strengthen CU's relationships with tribal communities and build programs that draw more Native students to the university. "To me, it's even a surprise that we are still here today," he said in a recent interview, reflecting on the challenges Native Americans have faced. "And to me now, how do we emphasize education and create the renaissance in the Indian community? That's what compels me to do this work. How do we maintain our language and our way of life? And how do we build on that for success in this world today?" Shendo, who also has experience in higher education, has been called one of the most powerful indigenous lawmakers in the New Mexico legislature, by New Mexico In Depth, a media outlet. He is now working at CU part-time, but plans to resign his Senate seat by early next year so he can move to full-time work in Boulder in March. His position is new for CU and is not one that every university has, although CU is following in the footsteps of others, including Colorado State University. Native American enrollment has been recovering at the Boulder campus in recent years from a decline that set in after it reached a recent high of 548 in 2019, according to university data. More students enrolled after the passage of a state law in 2021 that granted in-state tuition to Native students with ties to Colorado. The number of students who identify as Native American or Pacific Islander was 517 in 2022, and it reached 541 this year. Shendoe hopes to increase that. Earlier in his career, he was the Assistant Dean of Students for Native American Programs at Stanford University, and later was the Manager of Native American Programs at the University of New Mexico. He also served as the Cabinet Secretary for New Mexico's Indian Affairs Department and worked as a tribal administrator and lieutenant governor for the Pueblo of Jimenez. He has worked on infrastructure projects, water issues, and support programs for tribal members and students. Shendoe views Boulder and Metro Denver, which sit on ancestral tribal lands, as a crossroads for modern-day Native Americans. He wants to build upon the work that was done when he was an undergraduate student by organizations that help Native students. His new role will include forging stronger ties with tribal governments and communities throughout the state and region. He also plans to work with state and federal agencies involved in tribal affairs and higher education. His job will include developing new programs, but early on, he said, he will spend much of his time talking to tribes, Native communities, CU faculty members, staff members, and students to gauge what's needed. Those types of relationships are important for the tribes in the state, Shendoe said, especially because universities are repositories of a lot of things, including human remains and artifacts found on ancestral sites that need to be returned. Colorado is considered home to 48 contemporary tribes. Andrew Cowell, the faculty director of CU's Center for Native American and Indigenous Studies, served on the search committee that hired Shendoe. The role is meant to be outward-facing, Cowell said, so Shendoe's position is part of the university's Office of Government Relations. It was created after the discussions and passage of CU's land acknowledgement statement in 2020. His job is to interface with Native communities and really get a sense of what are the areas the students really want to study. Where should CU be trying to develop scholarship money? Or where do we need to develop better academic programs? Cowell said. The hope is that his work will result in more appealing programs as well as better mentoring and support. Cowell, who represents faculty members conducting research on Native issues, expects to work closely with Shendoe. James Rattling Leaf Sr., who was hired in September as the first part-time tribal advisor for CU's Cooperative Institute for Research in Environmental Sciences, said he was excited about Shendoe's appointment by Chancellor Phil DeStefano. Rattling Leaf, a member of the South Dakota Rosebud Sioux Tribe, works with scientists and researchers to build relationships with tribes through a variety of projects. Much of his focus is on what's known as traditional ecological knowledge, or TEK, which refers to the knowledge developed by indigenous people over time through their contact with the environment. He also underlines the need for reciprocity, with the tribes and the institutions benefiting from one another. As an example, he cited a grant his tribe received from the federal government to build the first climate center on a reservation. The tribe plans to draw on the university's research expertise, but also wants to ensure the center brings benefits for the tribe and the larger region. Once Shendoe has been in his new position for some time, Rattling Leaf said, the region will likely see more projects launched in that vein. CU has taken the first steps toward elevating its commitment to indigenous people, Rattling Leaf said. Now it's up to people like him, Shendo, and their allies to take it further. We live collectively on this planet now. We share the land, we share the air. And now that we have children, grandchildren, what kind of future are we going to help prepare for them? Rattling Leaf said. And I think we have to come together, and I think education has a role in that. Research has a role in that. Science has a role. Tech has a role. And tribes have a role in that. Cowles said responsibility for the success of Native students and those programs lies with the entire university. The creation of Shendo's position doesn't mean the job is done. I don't think we've solved all the problems here, and we can sit back and put our feet up, he said. The task ahead is to recognize the potential we have here for stronger relationships, whether it's with individual students on our campus or with tribal governments at large. Every Child Pediatrics nonprofit provides care, regardless of family's ability to pay for services, by Tiny Riccardi, the Denver Post. When Reed D. Spiegelair, Chief Development Officer at Every Child Pediatrics, talks about his work's mission, he points to the name of the nonprofit organization, Every Child Pediatrics. We see every child, D. Spiegelair said. We've never turned a child away. That holds true regardless of a family's ability to pay for medical services, from routine checkups, vaccines, and nutritional guidance to behavioral and mental health care. Every Child Pediatrics primarily sees kids who are uninsured or on Medicaid, offering a sliding scale for the cost of care comparable to each family's income. Kids with insurance are also welcome. As the needs of this population have grown, so too has the organization. Founded in 1996 as a single clinic in Denver, it has grown to 12 locations across the state. That includes 8 on school campuses, where Every Child Pediatrics operates health centers so that doctors and nurses can meet with kids where they're already spending time. De Spiegelair estimates that more than 57,000 children regularly receive medical care from Every Child Pediatrics. That ranges from newborn support in hospital maternity wards to young adult services for those in their early 20s. But De Spiegelair knows that support isn't always needed solely in a doctor's office, so the nonprofit employs what he calls care navigators, who work with families to help meet their other essential needs, whether that's access to transportation or household supplies. We screen everybody for the need for services, and then we have full-time navigators at every clinic to make sure we can meet with families, we can call families, we can navigate their referrals, De Spiegelair said. Then we actually partner with agencies that provide free diapers or free strollers, and we physically go get those resources and deliver them to families. That was especially important during the pandemic, as fewer patients traveled to medical offices. In 2020, Every Child Pediatrics quickly activated a telehealth program and rolled out an ambulance to use as a mobile office to reach kids in rural areas. With the ongoing affordable housing crisis and the recent influx of migrants, De Spiegelair expects Every Child Pediatrics will continue to be a go-to healthcare provider. It's unfortunate, I think, the need is growing, but also we are here to grow with that need, he said. There's only one limitation on our ability to grow. That limitation is, do we have community and donor support to fuel that growth? Individuals who donate to Every Child Pediatrics can support its wide range of services through its Care for Every Child Fund, as well as ancillary ones such as school supply drives or individual clinics. The organization provides robust data reporting, so donors know their dollars go exactly where intended if there's a specific facility or program they would like to support, De Spiegelair said. Every Child Pediatrics also offers volunteer opportunities and corporate partnerships that enable locals to support its mission. We are the largest safety net clinic for children in Colorado, De Spiegelair said. We have a place for everybody that wants to be a part of our mission to come on and join us. In brief from the Associated Press, expulsion vote. Santos says he expects to be kicked out of Congress, New York. Representative George Santos has said he expects to be expelled from Congress after a scathing report by the Republican-led House Ethics Committee that found substantial evidence of lawbreaking by the New York Republican. In a defiant speech Friday, sprinkled with taunts and obscenities aimed at his congressional colleagues, Santos insisted he was not going anywhere. "I know I'm going to get expelled when this expulsion resolution goes to the floor," he said during a talk on X Spaces. His decision not to seek re-election, he said, was not because of external pressure, but because of his frustration with the sheer arrogance of his colleagues. Thank you for joining us for the Denver Post. My name is Diane Adler.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aincolorado.org or by calling 303-786-7777.